I would like to open the floor for questions, comments from the floor, and then later on we can come back to the panelists for a response. I see Jayati, please, yeah.
Extremely interesting session and lots of different ideas and analysis. I have some questions for Sarah and Bola. Sarah, in fact, really following you on from Butch's questions, the fiscal stimulus, you know, you said that basically it seems to have succeeded, but your interviews were mainly with the local government officials, and obviously they'll say succeeded. I can't think of anywhere where the local government officials will say that, you know, the government program is not successful. So I'm wondering what is the evidence provided, not to say that it hasn't been, but specifically what is true and what is quite interesting in the Chinese case is that there's a sudden recovery in retail spending. There's a 15% increase in the year to May. And the Chinese government is claiming that this is a result of the specific incentives that were given to spending, you know, in a huge range of consumer durables, in automobiles and two-wheelers and refrigerators and air conditioners and so on. And that a large part of this, in fact, they are claiming that more than 50% of this comes from the rural areas. So it'd just be interesting to see whether you saw any particular impact of that. And secondly, the other positive thing which they actually have done is in terms of the health expenditure and the new health reform, which is actually going to cover all health expenditure up to 85%. I realize that, you know, since it was only announced in February and it will take time to work through, that you may not have seen the implications of that, but whether there was any evidence of that or whether people had at least noted this or was it at all happening in Sichuan province. Finally, just in terms of this point about the strong growth rate, like Butch, I also would argue that, in fact, a strong growth rate, once again, based on exports, would only heighten the imbalances and would not reduce poverty. And what you would actually need is a redirection of the growth, the pattern of growth, to a more consumption and wage-led pattern, which would directly impact on poverty, which means that you can actually live with a lower growth rate and more consumption, you know, rather than perpetuate the macro imbalance, which is anyway an unsustainable one. For Bola, again, also very interesting, and I like the historical way that you went about it. I just wanted to look at two of the very recent things that you mentioned. Well, one of them, in fact, you didn't mention, but it has to do also with Butch's point about infrastructure investment, which is that there's this new pattern of leasing out land. You know, Sudan, I think it's 14,000 hectares. Ethiopia, it's 11,000 hectares. Long-term leases to corporates from India, from China, from Saudi Arabia, from Kuwait, and from some European countries. And it's quite shocking that this is happening in food deficit countries. But the argument that the governments make is that this is arid land incidentally dominated by women cultivators, where land productivity is very low and these corporates are going to bring in investment to increase the output. They also recognize that this is not output that will be retained in the country, but they argue that this will create technological spillovers in African agriculture. So it would be interesting to get your reaction on that. I mean, I think it won't, but what do you think? And secondly, again, on this exogenous shock facility, it's not unconditional, even though they claim it is. The ESF for Ethiopia has already asked for a reduction in public deficit. The ESF for Malawi has actually asked for a reduction in the fertilizer subsidy, which has been critical in allowing Malawi to maintain food production and helped Malawi avoid the food crisis so far. So I would be very careful in advising countries to go to the IMF, ESF, because it's not unconditional.
I want also thank you for the very interesting presentations, and I also want to add comments on and build up on Boots' comments, but regarding Madhu's presentation, because we are seeing huge amounts of public resources mobilized through all these intervention packages to fight crisis in the shocks, and it's certainly much more complex issue than your experience was working in terms of mobilizing civil society. But I wanted also to comment you on the possibility of trying to use these experiences of civil society looking into how is this money implemented and what are the real outcomes of these packages.
I have just one small comment about public distribution system in Delhi. I think what is being pointed out is extremely important, but along with that, the low coverage, issue of low coverage is also important in the context of Delhi at least. Thing is that there are very few fair price shops. The BPL line is half a dollar per person per day in Delhi. And moreover, after targeting, we could not detect the poor. I know personally, I worked in some places like Madanpur Khadar and Jahangirpuri, etc. In those slums, very few people have got BPL cards. Actually, that is their main demand. So that way, and they don't have any nearby fair price shops also in most of the places. So I think that is also another important issue of low coverage. Thank you.
Are there any comments, questions? Yes, please.
A question for Mrs. Baduri's public distribution service. Would you say that as a result of the campaigns, the scope for corruption has sufficiently reduced for the system to have an impact on extreme poverty? Because we have a similar system in Iran, and there is evidence that there is linkages from the spillage from the system, but nonetheless, it seems to be effective in dealing with poverty.
Did Nilfer have a question or no? It's okay. Any others? Yes, behind the row behind, yes. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, I'm Mehri Noon from UNESCO. My question is from ex-ambassador Madhu Bahaduri. You briefly mentioned that the RTI bill might impact education as well, and I was wondering if you could comment a little more on that.
She couldn't quite hear it. Can you repeat once more? Ah, okay, she got it. Okay, sorry. Okay. Any others? Yes, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Metze Plakhansen. I'm coming from the UNDP gender team, and I have been enjoying very much this excellent panel and the others as well. I just have few questions, comments. I found it interesting that almost all the panels has touched upon the issue of employment programs, employment guarantees, and also have raised the issue that it might be not the most gender-sensitive focus, focusing on infrastructure and constructions, but that the focus for the employment generations might better including work areas where women are more present, or where it will help the inclusion of women in the labor market. And combining this with what we know about what barriers, the time powerlessness of women and the unpaid care burden, I was wondering if the focus could also include the what you call social infrastructure, in creating the employment in childcare, elder care, health care, where we know there is a huge deficit in order to public provision and a lack of services and lack of affordable services. So this was the one I want the comments on. The other is the issue of agricultural development or rural development, because I think it needs to be broader. You were asking for going more to the structural roots of the chronic food crisis and the returning difficulties. And I would ask if you might be able to elaborate a little more on how to actually then address these behind structural reasons of the continued lower productivity in the agricultural sectors than it should be. One issue could be land ownership and how this could improve and the access and control to facilities. I I like the approach that it's not should be special women target micro solutions, but should be kind of going to the structural and making it gender neutral or gender sensitive or responsive. Thank you.
Thank you. Shall we go back to the panel now? Is there anybody? Okay. So I would like to give first the floor to Ambassador Badri.
Thank you. Manuel, you have raised many, many questions, and there are questions also from two or three other people and participants. I'd like to take them all together. The first point you made, absolutely correct, that what people over the last 20 years, and this is not recent, the civil society, social activists over 20 years have been working that the only way to fight corruption, the only way to fight corruption was accountability. And accountability is not possible without transparency. And transparency, the answer to that is right to information. So this is the bottom line, should we say. You asked a very pertinent question, and that is, where is there resistance? You asked, is there resistance amongst people? And that connects me to the point, a question asked here, that why is it that some people don't even have the BPL ration cards in Delhi, despite so much work being done in Delhi? It's not because there is resistance amongst people. In fact, there is no resistance. In fact, we find that there is enormous enthusiasm amongst people. Resistance is within the government. Resistance is where the vested interest gets a blow. The resistance we felt initially, where the PDS is concerned, the public distribution system of food, was from the ration shop owners. You know, many people lost their licenses. New licenses were given to new people. The mafia rule has been somewhat cracked. I wouldn't say that it has completely been broken, but there is a possibility to crack it. And that enthusiasm has come in. Another question that was asked was whether there are other areas. Yes, the women who started, who became enthusiastic then, came to us and said, look, our children are not getting admission into proper schools. Now, the legal situation is that in Delhi, legally, every private school, however rich, however middle class, is legally bound to give 1/4 of admission seats in the school to the underprivileged children of very poor people. But they don't give it. So we went with RTI to those schools, took the matter up to the High Court, up to the Supreme Court. It took time. But now 300 children from these very slum areas are into good schools. And schools are beginning to realize that they cannot avoid this legal accountability. What they are now doing is, it's not schools only, hospitals as well. Hospitals were given land at very low cost with the understanding, not understanding, with the condition. Conditionality was that 1/4 of the bed occupancy will be going to the very poor and free of cost. They were not doing it. So we went to the hospitals and we asked for information. Who are the people you have given beds to? Give us their names, show us your files. The result is that they are all now going to the government and saying, we can't give 1/4, we'll give 1/10. But it has come to that. So there is accountability. It is possible. It's a procedure, it's a process which involves people. The resistance is not from the people. The resistance is from the government. You ask this question, why don't people in Jahangirpuri get BPL cards? Well, I was one of those who went with Santosh, the girl who got her neck cut. We went to the Chief Minister of Delhi and asked that you promised so many thousands of new cards, why haven't you given them? And her answer was, look, we can't do it. We can't do it because if we keep giving new cards, we'll get more and more migrant labor coming into Delhi, and Delhi does not have the infrastructure. So the resistance comes not from people. The resistance is from the government, and we have faced enormous resistance from the government to the extent that I mentioned to you that with media, with TV, with the TV company, the NDTV, which is something like CNN here, we were able to do a nationwide campaign to bring awareness about what RTI can achieve. A month after that, that is, this campaign was from 1st to the 15th of July 2006. On the 5th of August, government suddenly came up with a, it was a blow to us, that the cabinet, the ministers, or Air Delhi, with the prime minister heading it, had approved the amendment of the RTI Act. Do you know that civil society went into a rampage, and two very important social activists, Anna Hazare in Maharashtra and Sandeep Pandey in Delhi, went on hunger strike, indefinite hunger strike, that they were willing to die for it, but the government cannot weaken the accountability, the RTI Act. Government withdrew that. So the resistance is from the government. And if people move in, there is no way in a democracy. In a democracy, it is very difficult then for a government which wants votes not to move with the people. I'd like here to tell you where we have reached now. You see, this business of RTI has made people aware that they actually want greater participation. They want democracy at a level not only to be able to vote every 5 years, not enough. We want to be decision makers in what involves us. A small thing. In this very locality where we had the violence, we had all the women participating, and we have been able to change the ownership of ration shops. In this very locality, we asked, and this was the student group I went with, we asked for what were the engineering projects taken by the municipality for the area. And do you know, we got the papers with great difficulty, but one of the most amazing things we found was that 60 lakhs of rupees were spent in this slum area for allegedly building a fountain. There is no water supply, there is no sewage. It's all hand pumps by which the women get water. So the shocking thing was that 6 million was allegedly spent on creating a fountain. The fountain was never created, but the money had gone into the hands of the politician as well as into the pockets of the those who are supposed to have built this fountain. So now what people are asking for is, you cannot have plans and budgets without involving us. We want to be participants in where the money is being spent. We want to decide whether we want taps, we want sewage pipes, we want electricity, or we want a fountain. So what we have now come to through RTI is not only accountability, but a craving, a hunger for being able to be decision makers in their own areas. So this is where we are heading for. I think I have more or less answered the questions. Thank you.
So Sarah, would you like to hear?
Thanks for your questions. In response to Manuel's questions, the fiscal stimulus package actually had a heavy emphasis on the rural areas, in part because part of the stimulus package was funds that were slated to go to rural areas before the crisis hit. So those included projects such as accelerating rural infrastructure, also accelerating medical services, and accelerating Sichuan's reconstruction project. And then there were some that were also focused on the urban areas, but it had a heavy emphasis on rural areas. Women in particular were not specifically targeted, but it was hoped that some of the money would go to women as well, obviously. And then in response to Giretti's questions, we did talk to government officials. We also talked to professors. And we had to, at times, use our own judgment in terms of figuring out what was sort of the party line, which we got a lot of, and which was actually correct. And we didn't visit villages in Sichuan province, but we did go to several villages in Ningxia province. And we were able to actually see people working on roads and things like that, which was really great. Next, you asked about the consumer durables. I actually don't have monthly data on that. The National Bureau of Statistics does not release monthly data on consumer durables, even though they may report the data that they do have in the press. They don't release it to researchers. So it's possible that consumer durables increased because some rural incomes were increasing at the same time as other rural incomes were decreasing. I can see how that could be possible. In terms of health reform, that has not really hit yet. The health reform is set to create a lot of new institutions that are non-existent yet. And in terms of health insurance, the government has slated 2011 to have universal health care insurance. So they haven't really, that hasn't really been instituted yet. They also have to build hospitals and create sort of a system for, like, you know, medicine distribution and all kinds of really basic things. In terms of the growth rate and inequality, I totally agree with you. It's a real problem that China has a level of inequality that's almost the same as the U.S. And they really just need to build up their rural areas. They need industries in the rural areas rather than having everybody go to these other provinces that become enriched by the labor of very poor people. So I agree with that.
Thank you, sir. Would you like to respond, Mola?
Yeah, there are a number of questions on the paper, but I'll try to take them in a way, you know, well as to build into each other. The question about rural infrastructure or lack of it and its centrality to promoting large-scale agriculture in Africa, you know, has been a long-standing problem since the before liberalization, and most of the expenditure on infrastructure, rural infrastructure, came from some counterpart funding arrangement between IFIs and national governments in a lot of cases. There has been, in many cases too, inability of the local governments to meet up, you know, their own share of the funding, you know, leading to kind of a grounding of a lot of irrigation system, large-scale irrigation system. Also, along with this, well, many of the irrigation systems were set up against the backdrop of the production capabilities of small farmers. Many of them were set up without due regard to compatibility in terms of the machineries and equipment that would be required by small-scale farmers. And in lots of cases, governments failed to support farmers to use the irrigation facilities effectively. Also, the question of unforeseen environmental degradation accompanied many of these efforts, mostly in the 70s and early 80s. That's definitely before the days of liberalization, when attention shifted from such large-scale assistance to more of human development assistance. So that has been really the story why the rural infrastructure is still in a state neither incompatible technology, which has been mainly been the problem. But more recently, with emphasis on small-scale agriculture, there's a resort to smaller irrigation systems. That's as far as irrigation is concerned, like the Fadama. The Fadama is like a water harvesting system, which every farming household, you know, can adapt to. That has been more useful to promote, again, small-scale agriculture, just slightly above subsistence. But with respect to other infrastructure like roads, market, you know, storage infrastructure, most of it has been under public sector management. And with the inherent inefficiency, you know, like we've been talking about, the India case of lack of accountability is very instructive, and it permeates a lot of the public expenditure systems of African countries. So rural infrastructure has remained relegated, just as making it more difficult for farmers to move into large-scale agriculture and for farmers to benefit from any price incentive, because the cost of linkages are inherently very high. In terms of, you asked about the disincentive in price support programs. Price support and a price hike, they are like two ends of one good coin, because on one hand, price support is good to manage food security for the people, to manage to smoothen consumption. But on the other hand, price support hurts farmers who are looking to remunerative prices. I mean, every farmer is rational. You know, when the price is being managed and it is not profitable, it's a disincentive. But the argument has been that instead of government keeping the price incentive out, government could, you know, institute a kind of buyer program from farmers, buying from farmers at the remunerative price, and then supporting consumption through some other cash transfers, you know, directly to the people. So there has been a lot of argument about the efficacy of the price hike in itself. You know, that could it have been, is it good for farmers and is it bad for farmers? In a rational sense, in a rational economic sense, it's good for farmers. But where there are other constraints, it becomes a problem for consumption. For the poor, most of whom are farmers and their households. You asked about the linkage, some potential areas for women farmers. Well, these are new opportunities for all small farmers. When I talk about Africa moving from subsistence or small-scale orientation to commercial agriculture, it applies to everybody, both men and women. But where land is a critical factor in moving from small scale to large scale, women are better off in high value agriculture that is not so land dependent. And most of these projects occur in a peri-urban setting. Because they occur in peri-urban setting, slightly more educated women, you know, can access the facilities that are required. You know, the group support, access to more lines of credit, the information, the extension that is required. It's usually more accessible to the more educated women, because I must say that the liberalization and the reform of public sector has driven a lot of women back to farm, both men and women back to farm. And many of these educated women are taking advantage of peri-urban agriculture very, very effectively. That is why it's because the land constraint would actually be removed. The ESF and the PRGF. Well, I was wondering, too, why more countries have not taken advantage of that, rather extending the PRGF facility. But I think that basically different countries have different capacity to negotiate the terms, the conditionalities of the ESF. And of course, it has to be empirically, validated as qualifying shock, you know, with evidence that it is hurting specific aspects of the economy. Well, the capacity to do this and prove that it is really qualifying shock at any point in time You know, it varies with different countries. But we are yet to see where this is leading to. Definitely the PRSP countries would have to eventually, you know, look to taking advantage of this if this food crisis, you know, persists for much longer. Well, I don't remember any other question other than to add that drawing from the paper from the India paper, the issue of good governance in managing gender sensitive programs is really, really very important in most developing countries. You have a lot of leakages, you know, a lot of rent seekers when you have such programs. And you know, in a situation of sustainable democracy and where programs have been put in place to give women a voice, a lot is being achieved in terms of making public transfers or state transfers more open and more effective. Indeed, advocacy for gender budgeting has been hinged mainly on this right to be heard approach, where public budget hearings, you know, are now being advocated, where everybody has to know what the budget is assigned to do. And at the end of the day, with the civil society supporting them, they can monitor and ask, you were supposed to do this, you know, have you really delivered? Especially when the next election is coming and they come back and they want to get re-elected. So I want to reinforce that good governance is very, very central, and the voice of women at that political level has helped a lot to promote transparency in developing countries. Thank you.
Thank you, Bola. Would you like to add anything?
No. Ask Madhu if you would like to respond to one question that was asked here about whether you have seen a poverty impact of the better distribution of of the you know, of the ration cards. I thought that's a very interesting question. I mean, maybe it's too early. I don't know.
I think the proof of the pudding lies in the eating. The fact that the women who came with some skepticism initially have now become a movement. They want education for their children through the right to information because they are beginning to get their rations. Not only beginning to get their rations, they have been able to change the ownership of the ration shops. The government has now opened up every once a week. The women can go and check the records of the government, who is getting the ration. This itself is the big achievement. So it's not only food that they are getting, but where they don't get, they can go and find out. There is no doubt about one thing, that civil society has to needs also organizers. Social activism is the leading engine. Of that, there is no doubt. And I would also like to say that it has, this was one of your questions, Manuel, how has it gone from Delhi to other areas? There are areas where it is working very well, much better than in Delhi. Goa is one of them. Goa is the leading, Nagaland in the northeast is another one. So there are areas where it is doing extremely well, but there are other areas, and mind you, those are the areas where the Communist Party of India is in power, where it's not going at all. The resistance from the government in West Bengal and in Kerala is astonishing. They are just not doing it. And it will require much more civil society work for that to happen. Thank you.
Yes, I knew you were going to raise your hand. Would you like to readdress that question?
No, it's just for a short announcement. I think
In fact, since you asked this gender dimension of the, why is it that the meeting has been more focused on employment as a last resort, especially just focused on employment guarantee scheme as the entry point for job creation and employment creation, and whether we should not also think of engendering other types of income generation and employment creation. And since none of the panelists address this issue, and since I work for the International Labour Organization, maybe I could just respond to that. And I certainly agree that you know, employment creation should be more comprehensive in general, and it should be integrated as part and parcel of the overall development plans in different developing countries. At the macro level, macro policies to skills development policies to institution strengthening to even access to credit in general, but not only for microcredit, but also even a little bit larger side credits for small enterprise development sector, for instance. And that means it really has to be in a comprehensive approach, and I certainly agree what you have agree with what you have just said. I have taken advantage of the being in a chair. Nilufa, would you like to say something? Yes.
To this issue as one of the organizers of the conference. I think this is probably useful for us to point out that as a group of economists and activists, we have been discussing the relationship between gender and global economic crisis, not during this particular conference, but we have actually had a workshop that ran for two weeks, sorry. So we have been intensely discussing not only the relationship between gender and global economic crisis, but what kind of policies in general should be have a gender-aware starting point, and also not only gender, but we are also concerned with class all the time. So even though the title of the conference is Gender and Global Economic Crisis, we are concerned with the intersecting inequalities at all levels and how these inequalities produce and reproduce poverty. So we have been discussing a number of connections and interconnections and policy responses. And I should like to point out that in general, this kind of work that we do, we are, of course, at this moment discussing the situation of economic crisis and global financial and economic crisis. But we come, I think I can speak on behalf of a number of us here when I say that the problem is not just, quote unquote, that we have a global economic crisis, but we live in a world system in which inequalities are crucial to the functioning of the system at the level of the global, national, and local economies. So, yes, all policies should be examined from the point of view of gender inequality and all kinds of inequalities. And we simply have more papers on employment and employment guarantee schemes because for a very, very long time, in policy circles, when people talked about doing something that is gender aware in terms of a policy response, they had two things in mind. One was microfinance, and the other one was women's entrepreneurship in medium and small enterprises. And these were very often seen as the kinds of policy responses that would be gender aware. And our efforts are a little bit different in the sense that we are trying to look at the whole economy, macroeconomy, and the world economy from a gender-aware lens. And that means that all policies should be really changed, overhauled, if we want to have a vision of a world economy that is people-centered and humane and equitable for everyone. We have to really rehaul everything, all kinds of thinking. That would include monetary policy, exchange rate policy, and all kinds of policies, trade policies, and so on. We have discussed those in other fora and in other events and occasions and meetings, and we will certainly continue to do so. It is just that employment has become
it really needs to be seen as a very, very important and central aspect of the policy responses. It's not just we would advocate one thing, but we advocate a whole lot of things, a whole lot of policies, which must be in turn, of course, coherent among themselves.
Thank you, Nilfer. So this very interesting panel has addressed the deepening crisis involving the food crisis for all sorts of reasons. There were early on, we had a presentation on speculation of, in the world food commodity market by Dr. Jayati, and I think this Bola's presentation really also highlighted how the food crisis has not just been new, but also been continuing event. And I think it's been very interesting that, and also Ambassador Badri also has given the importance of improving efficiency and transparency in terms of delivering what the government pledged in terms of resource access for the poor. And Sarah has also done a very interesting presentation on her research on the how the external shocks have, in fact, shocks have impacted upon Chinese economy and especially the poor, including the poverty level, especially from the gender perspective in the rural areas. And I really think this has really further enriched the knowledge in terms of how the conference is progressing. And I really would like to once again thank all the distinguished panelists. Can we give a big hand to all the panelists?